You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/bcp.
Good morning. My name is Richard Bush. I'm the director of the Center for East Asia Policy Studies at Brookings and the proud holder of the Jun Fu and Cecilia Yan Gu Chair in Taiwan Studies. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to our program today on, quote, cross-strait relations at a juncture, Japanese and American perspectives. And we're very pleased to have two prominent scholars from Japan with us today. They came all the way from Tokyo, and they hope to be able to leave in spite of the weather. This is part of an ongoing program series that examines American and Japanese perspectives about issues of common concern. The premise is that because we are allies, the more our views about this or that problem are in common, the easier it is for us to act as allies. And back when we planned this program, I guess it was in the fall of last year, it seemed that the reason to do cross-strait relations was political change in Taiwan, the election of Tsai Ing-wen in January of last year, and everything that's happened since. It did not occur to me at the time that maybe political change in the United States might also affect the way we look at this problem, but there you are. Our speakers today, first are Yasuhiro Matsuda, who is a professor of international politics in the Institute of Advanced Studies on Asia at the University of Tokyo, Russell Hsiao, who is the executive director of the Global Taiwan Institute. He's worked at Project 2049 and the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. But he's also done a very good thing. He's forming and leading GTI, Global Taiwan Institute. He's provided greater coverage to Taiwan in D.C. through programs and publications. And, his energy and entrepreneurship has really made a contribution. Next is Chisako Masuo, who's associate professor at the Graduate School of Social and Cultural Studies at Kyushu University. And her research focuses on Chinese foreign policy, international relations in East Asia, and Sino-Japanese relations. And then there's me, and you know all about me, so I don't need to introduce myself. So what we're going to do is each of the speakers will speak from the podium in turn, and then we'll gather on the stage, maybe converse amongst ourselves for a little bit, but then open it up to questions. So, Professor Matsuda, please.
Good morning. I'm Yasuhiro Matsuda, and thank you very much for inviting me to express my opinion about cross-strait stalemate. And how should I put the slide on the screen? Okay. Thank you very much. Richard gave me the question that how do we assess and understand the stalemate situation between the mainland China and Taiwan. And I have just finished an article about this issue. So I have been trying to translate it in English slides. I describe the mainland China and Taiwan as cooperative antagonists because both of them share a kind of common interest, but they're enemies each other. So they do negotiations and sometimes bargainings and sometimes checks and tax and so on. So they have very big difficulties to reach an agreement on fundamental issues like One China or other sovereignty related issues. So the stalemate is, if the stalemate is mutually hurting a stalemate, there may be a window of opportunity to make some change to, to agree upon a certain level of consensus, like what happened during the Ma Ying-jeou administration, and try to stabilize the situation. But if the stalemate is mutually endurable, you know, the stalemate may, keep on. So I think that this is my, the analytical framework. And there are five possible outcomes of the cross-strait relations. That is, for example, win-win is the status quo, you know, coming from the Ma Ying-jeou's period. And I'm going to illustrate what happened in 2016. And based on this assumption, that was a kind of lost opportunity. Win-lose situation is that Taiwan accepts one China, and that's heading toward unification, and Taiwan is a loser. And lose-win is Taiwan rejects one China, and nothing happens. Then maybe the mainland China, Beijing, will be the loser. And lose-lose situation is crash of two nationalisms. And that's quite close to the to what happened during the Chen Shui-bian era. And I add one more possible outcome. That's not lose, not lose. That's the new normal of the cross-regulations. And they stopped all the existing, communication. But nothing happens. People are doing trades and tourism and so on. This may be the new situation. I think that I have just mentioned that both sides share the same, common interest. But from the viewpoint of structure, I think that they may be on the track of collision course. The aggregate power balance is, extremely tilting toward the PRC, and Xi Jinping is perceived as the hawk in terms of territory and sovereignty, and there are so many hawkish elements in the nation, and Tsai Ing-wen has gained a mandate to defend Taiwan's sovereignty, then through the presidential election, and of course DPP has a huge number of pro-independence elements, and especially if you take a look at the younger generation in Taiwan, it's so hard to find the people, the young people who have a Chinese identity. So, it seems like they're in the collision course. But there are many reasons to maintain status quo stability. For example, in China, China has very difficult relations with the United States, Japan, and other neighboring nations. And Taiwan has a huge economic dependence on Beijing. And the United States request of maintenance of the status quo. So both sides have good reasons to maintain status quo. At least stability is good for both of them. And there is the issue of a path dependence. Both of them experienced the Chen Shui-bian's era and Ma Ying-jeou's era. So they don't want to get back to the Chen Shui-bian's era. That was a nightmare for both of them. And Ma Ying-jeou's era was relatively good. And they started with the stability, the Ma Ying-jeou's era. So they don't want to break this stable situation. And both sides, on the other hand, have flexibility. You know, Tsai Ing-wen doesn't want to provoke China, and Xi Jinping doesn't want to break up the relations. So they both of them tried to avoid lose-lose situation, the fourth scenario I described a little while ago. Let's take a look what happened in the past 2 years. Xi Jinping, in the beginning, took a very hawkish stance against Tsai Ing-wen. He said, 基础不牢, 地动山摇, without foundation, political foundation, like 1992 consensus. The earth will move and the mountains will shake. Oh, that's a horrible, you know, statement. And that was his initial stance. And but after that, Tsai Ing-wen, Dr. Tsai Ing-wen, visited D.C. and made a speech, gave a speech at the CSIS, and she stressed that she's going to maintain the status quo, and she raised the question about the Taiwan, the Taiwanese people, you know, she will push for the peaceful and stable development of cross-strait relations in accordance with the will of the Taiwanese people and the existing ROC constitutional order. 现行中华民国宪法体制. And this was the first timing to witness the keywords that possibly be discussed by two sides of the you know, Taiwan Strait. And because KMT was in a very bad situation at that time, Tsai became the most hopeful candidate during the campaign. So China's response was very much self-restraint. You know, there are very few direct intervention to the president's election, and there was almost no personal attack to Tsai Ing-wen. So the situation began to change around the mid 2016. Actually, I said that the Xi Jinping also has a kind of flexibility. There are some you know, examples like Ge Wenzhe, the Taipei mayor, could successfully visit Shanghai even if he treated one China issue ambiguously. He said, it's on my wanting. There is no problem about one China, but for whom it is no problem. He didn't mention about that. And he said, 两岸一家亲, 总比一家仇好. 两岸一家亲, you know, the cross-strait relations, like the relations inside one family. You know, that, but this phrase is Xi Jinping's phrase. But he tactically used it, and it doesn't necessarily mean that he, you know, perfectly, you know, accept what Xi Jinping means. But he quoted it, and he also 理解与尊重九二共识, understand and 1992 consensus, and so on. Then he could visit Shanghai. This is one of the, you know, the flexibilities Xi Jinping, what Xi Jinping made. And this summit meeting was also initiated and by the Xi Jinping's leadership. And actually, at that time, I didn't really know that there was a hidden message toward, you know, Tsai Ing-wen. That was the first time for us to witness the keyword, the historical fact of the 1992 consensus, and agree with its core implications or core connotations. These two were also keywords. And it means that, you know, Xi Jinping gave a test to Tsai Ing-wen. It's a kind of a communication, Chinese way of communication with Taiwan. And Tsai Ing-wen, after her election, she also made the related you know, comments about the historical fact of 1992 before the election, but she confirmed it again in the during the very first interview with the Liberal Times. She mentioned about there are four key factors, and one is the historical fact of the 1992 consensus, the other is ROC constitutional institution, and so on. So there I believe that there was a kind of communication between them. Without communication, I think it's impossible. Yeah. And based on some document studies, we could understand that there are some more broken down questions or requests by Beijing to Taipei. For example, properly legislate cross-strait agreement inspection act, or properly choose personnel in charge of mainland affairs, and so on. And recognize, I named 1, 2, 3, 3A and 3B. And 3B is the major question. Clearly announced that both mainland China and Taiwan belong to one China, which is core connotation of the 1992 consensus. And this is extremely difficult for Taiwan. And time passed. You know, no response from Taipei, and Mr. Wang Yi made this very famous, comment about constitution. And after that, they denied, oh, it's not an official talk, and so on, so forth. But I don't believe that this is just a slipping his tongue and coincidence. I think that there is a kind of the context, of the communication between both sides. So, at this timing, the mainland China has come close to Taipei the most, but the deadlines of the both sides are different. The deadline of the Taipei was May 20th, inaugural address. You know, that should be the peak. But as for China, it's 1 year anniversary of Earth and Mountain. That was done in the National People's Congress, and it means that China can't wait more. So from the beginning of the of March last year, Beijing turned to pressuring Taiwan. We will resolutely contain the Taiwan independence. So this is a very much principle oriented comments about that. And China's diplomatic relations with Gambia resumed, and Taiwanese criminals deported from Kenya to Beijing, not Taipei, and mainland tourism to Taiwan reduces, and so on. So it turned to a pressure mode from negotiation mode. So the timing was not, coordinated well. And Tsai Ing-wen finally made inaugural address. Beside of this timing issue, I think that the transitional period of Taiwanese leadership change is too long. It's 4 months long, so everybody was so tired about that. So the longer the night, the nightmare, the more nightmares. So anyway, she made this inaugural address. And mentioned the fact of 1992 talks. It's a historical fact, and also she mentioned the existing Republic of China constitutional order. What is Republic of China constitution? That's accordingly it represents one China. Accordingly, I'm not sure about that, but Ms. Tsai, President Tsai, admitted that there is a historical fact about 1992 talks, and she indirectly mentioned that Taiwan's current constitutional order represents a certain kind of one China. So this is her response. And she also mentioned about the act of the act governing relations between the peoples of Taiwan area and the mainland area. This means that this act was legislated during the Li Denghui's period. So this was based on one China idea. So it means that Tsai Ing-wen would not pursue independence of Taiwan. And that's the message. She didn't said so. She didn't say so directly, but that was the message. So the initial response of the some scholars in the mainland China was quite positive, but it was quickly shut down. And their official response was an incomplete test answer. We want to know the answer. So, but it's not a grade D. but it's not A, somewhere between A and D. It's an incomplete test answer. And, the communication channels stopped. But, there are some, short messages, going back and forth, between the Cross-Strait. And, Taiwan could send delegations to WHA, World Health Assembly. But the delegation was, denied in IKO. But Taiwan could send James Sun as the representative of the president, deputy of the president, to APEC summit meeting. So it's a kind of inconsistent pressure. It's not a, I'm going to corner Tsai Ing-wen and strangle her. No, it's not that kind of pressure. However, it's so difficult for cross-strait relations to maintain a stable situation. For example, Tsai Ing-wen's phone call to Trump was, opened by Mr. Trump's Twitter. We are so busy with seeing his Twitter, and we are really surprised by this. And maybe it's a kind of punishment. San Tome Principe was taken away from Taiwan. And, the leadership also has shown some changes. Xi Jinping became the core of the leadership. But on the other hand, Tsai Ing-wen's approval ratings began to decline. So the best timing to make concessions, especially for Taiwan, was fading away. Only the strong leaderships can make a difficult decision and make some concessions. But still, neither leader is motivated to engage in actions to push Taiwan to the corner or provoke China's strong opposition. Both of them are still very much self-restrained. So this is a very strange stalemate. So how should we evaluate? How should we assess that? That's the question today. Based on my today's presentation, I think that they share the common interest. They share the common interest, but they are cooperative antagonists. They don't necessarily reach an agreement. If they think that reaching an agreement is dangerous for their domestic audience, they don't. But they don't want to get back to the lose-lose situation, like what happened during the Chen Shui-bian era. So they tried to manage the situation, but the timing was uncoordinated, unfortunately. The peak of the Beijing was the beginning, the February last year, but the Taipei was in Taipei. That was the May last year. And both sides didn't actually step closer to each other. They lost this opportunity, maybe. So if another chance, another opportunity will arrive this year or next year, I can describe that what happened in 2016 was a lost opportunity. because the stalemate was is mutually hurting, and they anyway have to reach an agreement and shake hands and resume all the communication channels, then that was a lost opportunity. We can describe so. But if this stalemate is mutually endurable, and it's much more dangerous to shake hands each other domestically, so they just leave it, and delay, and wait, and it may take a certain, you know, long period of time, 2 years, four years, or we can describe it. It's as not lose situation. It's a kind of the beginning. What happened in last year was the beginning of the new normal of the cross-strait relations. So did I answer Richard's question? please give me your evaluation. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, first of all, I want to thank Richard for this wonderful opportunity to address the audience today and talk about this topic, that a very important and timely topic. I also want to preface my comments by stating that my opinions here expressed today represent my personal opinions. So Matsuda-san provided a very good overview. I was first concerned when I was lined up second that it's possible that he would address all the current state of issues in cross-strait relations and would leave me basically repeating everything that he had said. But I think he led off in a really good way in that he addressed the structural basis and the structural challenges that the two sides face. And what I hope to do here is to give you a more detailed sort of timeline in terms of what has happened since the election of President Tsai Ing-wen in 2016. So the best place to start, of course, is in January 2016. After a campaign that predominantly focused on domestic issues, Tsai Ing-wen and the Democratic Progressive Party won a landslide victory in both the presidential and legislative elections. Tsai obtained 56.1% to her KMT opponent Eric Tsu's 31% of the votes. And after a few runoffs and all was said was done and done, Tsai's DPP and the Pan-Green Coalition held a total of 74 seats to the Pan-Blue Coalition of 39 seats among a total of 113, which makes the Pan-Green Coalition have a total of 64.6% of all the seats to the Pan-Blue Coalition of 33.6%. Beijing clearly favored the KMT, and that was probably, you know, the worst-kept secret in all of that. And yet in 2 short months, even before her inauguration, the PRC went on a diplomatic offensive. A wave of deportation began, despite Wang Yi's remarks here at CSIS that Matsuda-san had noted. On March 17th, the PRC announced that it was resuming diplomatic relations with Gambia. The smallest nation in Africa had seesawed between Taiwan and the PRC since gaining its independence in 1965. Gambia, however, in fact, broke diplomatic relations with Taiwan as far back as 2013, during the previous Ma administration, but was granted diplomatic relations with the PRC ostensibly because Beijing wanted to save the former president's face, but also because it probably saw it in its interest to retain this diplomatic card to hold over a possible return of the DPP, and the DPP did return. On May 20th, Tsai was inaugurated as the 7th and the first female president of Taiwan since the government was formed in the early 20th century. And after last week's impeachment of Park Geun-hye of South Korea, Tsai is now the only female president in East Asia. In her inauguration speech, President Tsai highlighted her administration's long-awaited policy towards cross-strait relations as being based on three pillars: the ROC Constitution, the Act governing relations between peoples of the Taiwan area and the mainland area, which includes 96 articles that governs the conduct of legal and administrative relations between the two governments. And three, the historical fact of the 1992 meetings. Beijing basically shrugged off the speech and called it an incomplete test answer, as Matsuda-san referred to. Tsai's approval rating at the time was 69.9%. So despite Tsai's apparent olive branch, the PRC announced in June that it was suspending government-to-government channels of communications. It was important to note here that there are many different channels of communications between the two sides of the strait. And what PRC was referring to were the channels between the Mainland Affairs Council and the Taiwan Affairs Office, and between ARATS and SCF. It's useful to note here that Tsai had yet nominated a chairman to replace the SCF chairman. And en route en route to Panama to attend the opening ceremony of the Panama Canal, one of Taiwan's few remaining diplomatic allies, Tsai transited through Miami and Los Angeles. In transits that were a far cry from the high-profile visits made by the Li Denghui and Chen Shui-bian, Tsai met with senior lawmakers but largely kept a low profile in any public statements that she had made. In the same month, Taiwan's Mainland Affairs Council conducted a public opinion poll and found that over 74.4% of the public supported the government's handling of cross-strait affairs according to the Republic of China Constitution, the Act governing relations between the people of the Taiwan area and the mainland area, and other relevant legislation. A follow-up MAC poll in August found that 80% of the public support the government's cross-strait policy stance of commitment to maintaining peaceful and stable cross-strait relations since May 20th. That's at 83.8%. And over 70% of the public support handling cross-strait relations by democratic mechanisms in line with public opinion, 77.5%. And nearly 90% of the public supported continued handling of cross-strait affairs through communications, contact, and a negotiating mechanism at 89.1%. In September, interestingly, an organization with obscure and deep ties with the PLA and the PRC government, the China Energy Fund Committee, which describes itself as a high-end strategic think tank, hosted a very interesting focused conference called in Washington, D.C., of all places, entitled A War to Remember, United Chinese Effort Against Japanese Invasion. The event largely flew beneath the radar of most analysts and interestingly presented a keynote remark by Hao Bozun, who previously served as premier and also chief of staff of the ROC Armed Forces. I think for anyone who has an interest in terms of a deep dive on the general political department of which the China Energy Fund Committee is affiliated with, I would recommend them reading the report that was released by the Project 2049 Institute in 2013. So you might be wondering why I'm mentioning a conference in D.C. at a seminar about cross-strait relations. This is because I believe that D.C. is now at the epicenter of cross-strait relations. In my opinion, Beijing has determined that the efficacy of working with Taipei under the Tsai administration is perhaps not in its interest, and found that it would be more to its advantage to persuade Washington to apply pressure on Taiwan to accept its terms for cross-strait negotiations rather than working directly with Tsai. In the same month, Tsai appointed former Foreign Minister Tian Hongbao to serve as chairman of the semi-official Straits Exchange Foundation, which conducts diplomacy between Taiwan and the PRC. In the following month, on a day meant to celebrate the events leading up to the establishment of the ROC government, Double 10, Tsai issued her first major policy speech on cross-strait relations after becoming president. Most notably, President Tsai called on Beijing's leaders to face up to the reality that the Republic of China exists and that the two sides of the strait should sit down and talk as soon as possible. In my opinion, contrary to the PRC's assertion, the objective reality is that the ROC did not cease to exist in 1949. After the PRC was established, nor did it cease to exist in 1979 when the United States de-recognized Taiwan. President Tsai, in her speech, added that anything can be included for discussion as long as it is conducive to the development of cross-strait peace and the welfare of people on both sides. In a very wide-ranging speech that was intended to focus on cross-strait relations and clearly very high profile, President Tsai led in with what she felt, I think, was the most pressing concerns facing Taiwan, and those were the domestic issues, such as youth employment, affordable housing, pension reform, transitional justice, and industrial reform. Interestingly, the cross-strait relations sections of the speech was preceded by an extensive coverage of Taiwan's international space and the new government's regional policy, such as the new southbound policy. More specifically, cross-strait relations were addressed in the context of regional developments. This may be seen as an effort by the new administration to embed its China policy within a broader regional strategy, in contrast to the previous administration, which had a far more China-centric approach. In November of last year, in an unprecedented move, the PRC officially commemorated the birth of the founder of the Nationalist Party and the ROC, Sun Yat-sen. The official ceremony held on November 11th was attended by 6 out of the 7 members of the powerful CCP Politburo Standing Committee. The CCP leaders waxed lyrical about Sun's legacy and hoisted him up as a symbol of Chinese unity. And in his speech, CCP General Secretary and PRC President Xi Jinping boldly proclaimed that CCP members are the firmest supporters, most loyal collaborators, and the most faithful successors of Mr. Sun Yat-sen's revolutionary undertakings. Not hiding the proverbial political ball of his speech, she emphasized that the so-called 1992 consensus must be the political foundation for cross-strait dialogue, and furthermore asserted that we, CCP, will never allow anyone, any organization, any party to split off any tract of territory from China anytime or in any way. Later that month, then head of the influential government research institution, the Institute of Taiwan Studies at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, Zhou Zhihui, spoke in an academic forum in Guangxi province on November 30th and stated that Beijing does not oppose the idea of the 1992 consensus being substituted by a creative alternative. In the same month, the KMT chairwoman and the party's first 2016 presidential candidate, Hong Xiuzhu, led a delegation to the PRC to attend the annual KMT CCP forum and met with Xi for a ceremonial photo op. The forum, which started in 2015 after the Lianzhen and Hu Jintao meeting, have had 12 meetings since then, between 2006 and 2016. In perhaps an effort to position her party as the only interlocutor between the PRC and Taiwan. However, I think Hong may have inadvertently moved her party farther from the Taiwan mainstream. Despite the relatively stable relationship between the two sides, relative, the Tsai's approval rating continued to slump and reached 41.4%. Then on December 2nd, President-elect Trump accepted a congratulatory phone call from the democratically elected leader of Taiwan. And during the brief 10-minute exchange, President Tsai congratulated the president-elect on his election victory and exchanged views about the economy and regional issues. And to use a technical IR term here, all hell broke loose. Speaking before reporters immediately after the phone call, PRC Foreign Minister Wang Yi blamed the Thai government for orchestrating the exchange and exchange between the two leaders. He said, quote, "This is just the Taiwan side engaging in a petty action," or xiaodongzuo. I know that there's a lot of interpretation in terms of how to directly translate that, and cannot change the one China structure already formed by the international community. On December 3rd, Beijing lodged a formal diplomatic protest and solemn representation with Washington that reiterated the importance of the One China policy, urging the United States to cautiously, properly handle the Taiwan issue to avoid unnecessary disturbance to Sino-U.S. relations. In a sign of escalation on December 10th, Chinese military aircraft took off from the PLA's Eastern Theater Command in an exercise that circled around Taiwan. At least 4 aircraft were involved in a long-range military exercise that covered Taiwan's eastern shore, flew around Taiwan's southern airspace spanning the Bashi Channel off the southern tip of Taiwan in the Luzon Strait, and paired up with advanced fighters from the PLA Southern Theater Command. Although similar exercises had been held back in September, the latest sortie in December follows quickly on the heels of another exercise that took place on November 25th. If people recall the episode, it was actually the Japan Self-Defense Force that revealed that the 6 aircraft that entered Japanese airspace included 2 Su-30s, and I'm talking about the November 25th exercise. The flight report path reportedly spanned the strategic airspace along the Miyako Strait, which lies south of Japanese island Okinawa, that prompted the Taiwan government to respond. So one day later, Trump stirred another hornet's nest after December 10th, and he stated, "I don't know why we, the United States, have to be bound by a one-China policy unless we make a deal with China having to do with other things, including trade." Compounding the pressure is PRC's squeeze on Taiwan's international space. Since Tsai was elected president, and even before her inauguration, Beijing has already began to ratchet up political pressure on Taiwan's international space with a blitzkrieg of deportations of Taiwan nationals to Beijing, all on the basis of its One China principle, or the assertion of its One China principle that were adopted by and agreed to by other countries. As Matsu-san referred to, the small African nation, Sao Tome and Principe, flipped on December 20th. Nigeria announced that it was degrading its unofficial relations with Taiwan on January 11th. And now Taiwan only has 21 allies, diplomatic allies, compared to more than 170 that recognized the PRC. Things really started to heat up in January 2017 of this year. First, the PLA sailed as aircraft carrier and other warships up the Taiwan Strait. As I mentioned earlier, the PRC forced Nigeria to downgrade, or persuaded Nigeria to downgrade its already informal relations with Taiwan by forcing its representative office to move from the capital. And then when Thai transited through San Francisco and Houston, the PRC Consul General in Houston sent letters to members of Congress urging them to not meet with the leader of Taiwan. One member of Congress who received a letter, Senator Ted Cruz, a former Supreme Court law clerk and presidential candidate, sounded a defiant tone. He said, "The People's Republic of China needs to understand that in America we make decisions about meeting with visitors for ourselves." Senator Cruz added that, "This is not about the PRC. This is about the U.S. relationship with Taiwan, an ally we are legally bound to defend. The Chinese do not give us veto power over those with whom they meet. We will continue to meet with anyone, including the Taiwanese, as we see fit." In January 2017, Thai's approval rating dropped around 8% from November, which isn't too bad when you consider the close to 30% drop from May to November at that time. I would also add that this is actually a pattern that is not necessarily unique to Thai's administration, and then the previous two administrations, both Ma as well as Chen Shui-bian, there has been a precipitous drop in the approval ratings of both presidents when they were after they were elected. I think, in my opinion, the most substantive changes came last month in February, which was a month of change in the PRC's Taiwan policy community. The head of ITS, whom I mentioned earlier, Zhou Zihuai, was replaced by Yang Mingjie, who was the 52-year-old Yang served as associate dean of the China Institute of Contemporary International Relations. He's not a Taiwan expert like his predecessor. He's a graduate of the prestigious Peking University and has very much and much more international relations focused. He was also a visiting researcher at the Stimson Center here in Washington, as well as a researcher at the Japan-based Institute of International Policy Studies. Also last month, it was announced that Dai Bingguo, the former state council, was taking over as chairman of the National Society of Taiwan Studies. I think it's interesting to note that that organization is stacked with government officials at the deputy chairman level. Consists of four deputy chairmen, Li Yafei, Cai Fang, Zheng Jianbang, and Sun Yafu. Li serves as a deputy director of the CCP Central Committee's Taiwan office, the State Council's Taiwan office, and as vice president of the Associate ARATS. Cai also serves as the vice chairman of the Premier Government Research Institution, CAS, and Zheng serves as chairman of the Chinese Kuomintang Revolutionary Committee. And Sun serves as the vice president of ARATS. I think given the function of these institutions, these appointments seem to suggest an emphasis on external factors weighing in on cross-strait relations. I thought, in the interest of time, I believe my time is, running up. I just want to point out a few interesting developments that happened also in February. One in particular that stood out to me was the commemoration of the 228 incident and the events of how the Taiwan Affairs Office spokesperson weighed in and asserted that the 228 is a part of the Chinese liberation struggle. I think while the commemorative event it represents nothing new, it could be seen as a broader effort to reinterpret historical events to suit the CCP's political narrative. Some analysts interpret this as a signal that the CCP is willing to be critical to the KMT. It begs the question why. And while I think criticizing the KMT may be motivated by a desire to appeal to the Taiwanese public, it also represents a sophisticated attempt to usurp Taiwanese political symbols. So what does this all mean? I know that, since in the interest of time here, what I'd like to do is we can leave the rest of the discussion here toward the for the facilitated discussion. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. It is my great honor to deliver a talk to such distinguished audiences here in Brookings. I am Chisako Masu, who studies Chinese foreign policy, especially toward its neighbors. I was here about a year ago to talk on Russo-Chinese relations, but wasn't clever enough to foresee to come back to Washington, D.C., where President Trump has the White House. surrounded by three distinguished scholars on Taiwan issue, my job, my humble job here, is to describe the regional architecture or the changes in the regional architecture surrounding Taiwan. The beginning of my title might sound a bit shocking to some Americans, American retreat from Asia. What I want to say here is that in Asia, there is some atmosphere to make you believe that American hegemony is over upon the rise of China. It is strong in East Asia, probably except Japan, that still remains high expectations for the United States' role in this region. I'm sure that many of you remember that the year 2012, when China's maritime issues were highlighted, in April, there was the standoff with Philippines over Scarborough Shoal. In September, the regime mobilized aggressive demonstrations against Japanese companies and factories in all over China when the Japanese government purchased three Senkaku Islands from a private owner. It was also about when China started to plan the island building on the features in Spratly, according to my research. Xi Jinping became the leader of the Communist Party of China in November that year. Surrounded by the hostile environment China had created by itself, Xi and his colleagues made very clever decisions, I think. Within a year, they initiated so-called One Belt, One Road, or OBR, together with AIIB, and persuaded the world that it should focus on everyone's common issue or common interest, economic development. Because there were many countries that wanted to gain more from Chinese growth, Beijing successfully changed people's foci and shaped a new discourse that might bring fortunes to many developing countries in Eurasia and Africa, and it also continued building the military bases in the Spratly. In this picture, the United States is a humble... I should return. In this picture, the United States is a humble actor who occasionally conducts the freedom of navigation in the South China Sea, but cannot contain China to stop it. Many countries wanted the U.S. to participate creating a new economic framework called TPP, but President Trump clearly refused it. Looking from Asia, it is now the Chinese initiative that is shaping the new regional order already. President Duterte showed obedience to Beijing, although Philippines achieved complete victory in the PCA arbitration. Now, nobody wants to make China angry. Talking with many scholars from ASEAN, you get a sense that the past 1 year was critical for their mind shift. If you look at the map of Chinese over, you find that it is a huge concept that goes around the Eurasian continent as well as the Indian Ocean. There are many ways to interpret the rationalities of this concept, but at least there are the areas where China plans to extend its economic influence in coming decades in cooperation with the countries concerned. In this sense, China is clearly planning to compete with the American global hegemony. However, for now, China's influence is relatively limited to its immediate neighbors. China has a concept called peripheral diplomacy. The relations with those countries are considered to be important because they can directly impact Chinese security. In the course of its ascendance, China's influence over its immediate neighbors is expanding. In the same time, the way China treats the neighbors seem to be also changing at rapid pace. In the past several years, China often resort to harassment or punishment to those countries when they did not respect Beijing's will. In this sense, the Chinese leaders are more power-centered and already treat those neighboring countries as if they were a part of its kingdom. This chart, this is a very rough chart, roughly shows the vulnerability of smaller actors toward regional actors toward Beijing. This is just my image, but I wanted to describe that all the regional actors face similar pressure from Beijing, though in different in degrees. As many of you are aware, China now has a tighter control over Hong Kong, although it's been only 20 years since unification, not 50. The next victim is probably Taiwan. It is always watched and controlled on the international arena. Then other regional countries follow. If you have higher vulnerability, the risk of punishment from China is bigger, and you always have to pay attention to China's evaluation on you. Upon China's rise, today's Hong Kong will be tomorrow's Taiwan, and today's Taiwan will be tomorrow's Vietnam. Recently, we have seen many interesting examples of Chinese coercive measures against those neighboring entities. Rare earth, banana, Lotte boycotts. China tends to resort these measures on sovereignty-related issues, which are often for the opponents, too. But the third case in the South Korea will be something different. It's more on security, which probably means that China is expanding its scope for punishment than before. Because China gets angry relatively easy toward its neighbors, smaller entities are encouraged to keep low profile to deal with China after seeing some examples on themselves or neighbors. However, the hatred, I would say, will accumulate against Beijing for not respecting smaller actors' interest in the long run. The maintenance of such regional order could be very costly for China, even if it was achieved. And Tsai Ing-wen's Taiwan is no exception. She has been very discreet and never aggressive when handling the China issues, unlike Chen Shui-bian, the former DPP president who served until 2008. However, knowing many Taiwanese concerns on China's expanding influence over Taiwan, she quietly resisted fully acknowledging so-called 92 consensus on One China upon inauguration. After Tsai's victory over the presidential election, China's harassment against her continued, first by ending the diplomatic ceasefire during Ma Ying-jeou administration and normalizing the relations with Gambia, and second by deterring Taiwanese participation to the international organization in some ways. And Kenya deported Taiwanese suspects on internet fraud, presumably under the Chinese influence, and similar cases followed throughout the following year. Her telephone call with the president-elect Donald Trump on December 2 probably became a watershed for Beijing's anger over her. After Mr. Trump tweeted this news by calling her the president of Taiwan, Beijing started to move for cutting Taiwan's friendly ties with San Principe Tome in the same month and Nigeria the next month. Now there are only 20 countries that recognize the Republic of China. Well, while she was visiting Latin America, Chinese aircraft carrier entered Taiwan Strait as if to coerce her people. But then President Trump easily abandoned Taiwan by honoring One China policy in his phone call to President Xi Jinping in February. Tsai was left alone with angry China. When National People's Congress was held in March, Premier Li Keqiang upgraded the tone for criticizing Taiwan from the previous year and underlined the need to contain Taiwan's independence movement. National unification law was said to be discussed during the conference. clearly, Tsai Ing-wen's, she is under a severe pressure from China, who is now more confident about its military power and economic influence. China might be approaching Vatican for diplomatic normalization as the next step. Although many countries are sympathetic about Taiwan's situations, they cannot help it because they don't want to make troubles with Beijing. Taiwan's international space will be smaller under Beijing's growing influence. Taiwan cannot go out for a multilateral organization without Beijing's consent. In this picture, there are only two choices for Taiwan to forge better relations than now. One is Japan, probably. Among Taiwan's neighbors, Japan is the only country who dare to say no to China. I think in Asia, there are probably two countries, and another one is India, but India doesn't have much closer relationship with Taiwan. Japan is the third economy in the world still. Its relations with Beijing is not going well anyway, so that Prime Minister Abe doesn't have to worry much about deteriorating relations with Beijing. Starting from January 1st this year, Japan's representative on Taiwanese affairs renamed itself as Japan-Taiwan Exchange Association. Corresponding action is planned to be followed by the Taiwanese side soon. And the U.S. For Taiwan, the relations with Trump administration will be a key for its survival. However, there lies the biggest uncertainties. We do not know if he has any clear picture on Asia policy in whole. Judging from Taiwanese strategic position, the value of the island should not be downgraded, though. It is at right in the middle between East China Sea and the South China Sea, where China uses to go out for the Pacific and the Indian Ocean. If China can take over Taiwan, it will stand on a very favorable position as a global sea power. However, I'm not certain how much the U.S. Still interested to cooperate with China in those compete with China in those areas when it is so much occupied with Russian and Middle East matters. So in such situations, the best way for Taiwan to keep a low-key stance for survival, for its survival policy, so that it won't be attacked from Beijing in a much severe way. Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank each of the speakers so far. They've covered a lot of ground, and I hope I don't tread on the ground that they've already covered. I'd like to talk about four things. First of all, briefly, the state of play between the mainland and Taiwan. Second, my thoughts on why we have the current situation that we do. Third, say a little bit about my understanding of President Tsai Ing-wen's strategy, and then talk about U.S. policy. Going back a year ago, there was some hope that the two sides of the strait could work out some sort of modus vivendi. Now, this was not because of the position of the Taiwan Affairs Office, but in spite of it. As Professor Matsuda has said, there is evidence that there were other communications channels that existed and that these, at least for a while, were productive. So there was some hope. As it turned out, the hope was not realized. And again, Professor Matsuda I think, noted the difficulties of using that kind of interaction to lay a foundation for the relationship. As a result of this failure, we've seen a number of actions on the PRC's part that suggest efforts to pressure and even punish Taiwan. First of all, the number of tourists, or at least group tourists, going from the mainland to Taiwan is down. The official channels between the Mainland Affairs Council and the Taiwan Affairs Office, between the Straits Exchange Foundation and the Association for Relations Across the Strait, have been suspended. At the working level, Beijing has been slow to engage on implementation of agreements that already exist and where you would expect interaction to continue. This is based on reports from the Taiwan media. Mainland propaganda tends to associate President Tsai with Taiwan independence. On the diplomatic front, as already mentioned, you have cases like Gambia and San Tome and Principe. Then there's the case of Interpol and ICAO. Beijing has not resisted united front efforts, and so it is giving preference to blue counties over green counties. There's talk in China about the 19th Party Congress adopting quote-unquote new language concerning Taiwan. There's also talk about enacting a unification law to go with the anti-secession law. And the list goes on. I would mention one other thing, and it doesn't seem on first glance to be relevant to cross-strait relations, but I think it is. I would refer you to a really fascinating article in the March 6th issue of The New Yorker. It's about Russia and Vladimir Putin's special measures to try and affect the U.S. 2016 election and undermine the U.S. political system. It's kind of a playbook about how any country, through a variety of means, can try to affect the democratic system of another. I'm sure a lot of these things have occurred to at least some people in China. Whether they'll be acted on is another question. So what's going on here? How do we explain this failure to create a pattern of coexistence between Beijing, which we know doesn't like the DPP, and Tsai Ing-wen and her administration, which wants to maintain their version of the status quo? Professor Matsuda spoke of a missed opportunity as one explanation, that it was very difficult, if not impossible, for the two sides to reach that modus vivendi. And he suggests that as a result, what we may have is a new normal of cold confrontation. His conclusions are correct, I think, but I think something else is going on as well. And so we have to step back and analyze the interaction, what it means and what it doesn't mean. The PRC is very good at stating a version of reality over and over and over again, to the point that sort of general observers come to the conclusion that that must be what reality is. And so their narrative in this case is Tsai has refused to accept the 1992 consensus and its core connotation that the mainland and Taiwan both belong to one China. Moreover, Beijing has insisted that it wants explicit acceptance as some in China say, we need to know what this entity is that we might be dealing with. Is it a separate state? Is it an entity on the way to independence, or is it part of one China? But let's step back from this demand for explicit acceptance of one China. First of all, let us note that China knows how to use nuance and ambiguity to achieve its diplomatic or political objectives when it wants to. It doesn't necessarily need to have explicit categorical statements. It certainly has used them in U.S.-China relations. It asks in a way that this be the way that the United States approach North Korea and that we stop making our sort of very explicit demands on Pyongyang. Stepping back one more step, I think I understand, I do understand that Beijing believes that it has difficulty trusting Tsai Ing-wen. And, scholars there have accumulated a lot of evidence, both in terms of Tsai Ing-wen's past and then the actions that have occurred on her watch to justify why mistrust is their default position. So, for example, in the present, there's a lot of attention being given now on the mainland to moves towards, quote, cultural independence, unquote. So, let's accept that China thinks it has reasons to mistrust Tsai Ing-wen and that it therefore wants reassurance. Hence the characterization of her inaugural address as an incomplete test paper. Complete the test paper, please. We don't trust you. We've seen the way in which Beijing wants to be reassured. The question that is not asked is, does Taiwan have reason to mistrust the mainland? Does Tsai Ing-wen have reason to mistrust Xi Jinping's intentions? Of course they do. There's a lot in PRC policies and behavior that would lead Taiwan people and President Tsai to have serious doubts. Now, if this is a situation of mutual mistrust, then perhaps the way to resolve it is not unilateral reassurance, Tsai Ing-wen completing the test paper in the way that Beijing wants it completed, but it's mutual reassurance. Professor Matsuda, I think, had a very good analytic framework. And lurking behind it, I see prisoner's dilemma, right? Yeah, he agreed. And that's very interesting because prisoner's dilemma, there are two ways to look at that. And that is that if you have a situation where cooperation should be possible, but each side has reasons to mistrust the other, if you go through just one round of the game, then you are liable to miss an opportunity. However, if you can play the game over and over again, then the two mistrusting sides have a basis over time to come to a point where they can trust each other and seize the opportunity. By this logic, what China and Taiwan should be doing is trust building that is incremental, reciprocal, that is each side responds to the move of the other, and proportionate, that each side is willing to take small moves in the beginning from the other side and building up to bigger moves. This is what I thought might be possible a year ago. It does not seem possible now. And the fundamental problem here is that Beijing sees this as a question of one-way mistrust and a requirement for one-way reassurance. Partly this, I think, has to do with defects in the PRC system. I frankly don't know how Beijing could believe that Tsai Ing-wen could not reassure it in an explicit way, given the political realities in Taiwan, at least at the beginning. So why did they make their explicit demand in the first place? My hypothesis is that in addition to sort of the dynamics of prisoner's dilemma and the likelihood of missed opportunity, is that Beijing really doesn't want to deal with Tsai Ing-wen. It doesn't want to get to a position of coexistence, because that raises the likelihood that it would have to deal with the DPP government for a long time to come. So it issues demands that it knows it cannot accept, that Tsai Ing-wen cannot accept. And it creates circumstances, it hopes, for the KMT to return to power. There's a certain logic there. I wish I was wrong, but I think that that's what is probably going on here. Now, as far as Tsai Ing-wen is concerned and her political strategy and so on, it's in my way of thinking, it's useful to think of her as playing on four chessboards at one time. One is cross-strait relations. One is domestic politics. One is what I call domestic policy. It's basically her interaction with the bureaucracy and interaction with the United States. And, you know, it's complicated enough to have to deal with four issues at once, but this is really complicated because if she moves a piece on one board, then it moves the pieces on all the other boards as well. So in making a move concerning domestic politics, she has to think about, you know, the implications for domestic politics, for domestic policy, for mainland relations, and for U.S. relations. I think that that she saw the need to balance these different priorities and hopefully do so in a mutually reinforcing way. The same thing may have been going on in the Chen Shui-bian administration, at least early on, but we can talk about that later. Now, if my analysis of her strategy is correct, that, and as she said, that cross-strait relations is as important as U.S. relations, among other things, and if she believes, as I think Russell said, that her main agenda is domestic, then Taiwan independence, which Beijing fears, would be a fool's errand for her. And Tsai Ing-wen is no fool. I think that intellectually, Beijing understands Tsai's domestic situation, but it is not willing to sort of accommodate to it for reasons that I've suggested. This leads to the question of where's the United States in all of this? If we look back to the Obama administration and its approach to cross-strait relations, seems like a very long time ago, actually. But since May 2015, when Susan Thornton made an address on this stage, the theme of our cross-strait policy was we called on both sides to be restrained, flexible, creative, and patient. And that makes sense. It fits with the idea that the two sides, if they were all of these things, could work out a modus vivendi. Based on my humble opinion, I think by these standards that Susan Thornton laid out, Taiwan has performed well and Beijing hasn't. Now, we move to Donald Trump. There are a lot of rumors floating around about what his policy concerning Taiwan might be. Apparently, there are ideas about changing the conduct of our relations with Taiwan in a positive direction. And I think his phone call to Tsai Ing-wen in early December was an example of that kind of step. Second, it is clear that at least in his mind, he sees Taiwan or the One China policy as something that can be put in play in interactions with Beijing in order to enhance his leverage to get things that he wants, as on North Korea and trade and so on. Now, since then, there has been some reaffirmation of past policy. State Department replying to questions from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee after Rex Tillerson's confirmation hearing said, the three communiques, that's especially important, Taiwan Relations Act and Six Assurances provide the framework, the foundation for U.S. policy towards China and Taiwan. The United States should continue to uphold the One China policy and support a peaceful and mutually agreeable cross-strait outcome, et cetera, et cetera. In response to a specific question about using Taiwan as a bargaining chip vis-a-vis Beijing, the answer was, and this is Tillerson speaking, if confirmed, I intend to support the One China policy. The people of Taiwan are friends of the United States and should not be treated as a bargaining chip. The U.S. commitment to Taiwan is both a legal commitment and a moral imperative. If confirmed, I would work to ensure economic and military stability across the strait. And then, as we know, President Trump himself on February 9th said that he would honor the One China policy and was doing so at Xi Jinping's request. There's a lot going on. As I suggested in my introductory remarks, the current situation was set in motion by Tsai Ing-wen's election, and then you have Beijing's response. The new variable at play is the new administration and how President Trump and his team seek to engage China and support Taiwan and relate the two to each other. So now I'd like to ask each of the presenters to come up on stage, and we'll have a little bit of a discussion here, and then we'll turn to questions. Thank you. So, wait for the mics. There we go. Okay, first, Professor Matsuda, I would like to ask you if you have any follow-up comments based on my observation that you were using Prisoner's Dilemma, and that can be a very useful template for understanding what's going on.
Thank you for all your comments and for the supplementary mention about the prisoner's dilemma. And actually, my conclusions, there are two conclusions, you know, because it's still too early to make a final conclusion. So the subtitle is the lost opportunity or the dawn of the new normal? It's still, you know, uncertain. And I think that both sides may step closer to each other in the future. For example, if the major problems of both sides are, for example, the lack of or the weak power base, for example, in the mainland side, I think that the 19th Party Congress is going to be the turning point, maybe going to the turning point. For example, if we take a look back what happened in 1997 to 1998, it was right after the third cross-strait crisis. But still, you know, after the 15th Party Congress, the Jiang Zemin consolidated his power base, and the nuance of the Beijing's comments on the cross-strait relations changed. Then both sides began to interrupt each other, and the second Wan Tao Han Gu Zhenfu meeting got materialized in 1998. So there is no impossible thing in the political world. So I think that this is one. You know, one thing we have to think about that. Maybe what happened in 2016 was a missed opportunity, and both sides may try again and again. Mm-hmm. So I don't exclude the possibility of the next round of, you know, interaction.
Well, that's certainly, I think, the view among some scholars on Taiwan, that Xi Jinping has domestic political issues in the run-up to the 19th Party Congress, and that if there's going to be movement in a positive direction, you have to wait till then. Russell, you said something about having thoughts about implications of your chronology. I want to give you a chance to talk about them.
Thank you, Richard. I really appreciate that. You know, I think if I had some parting observations and implications, it would be that, and I hope that this came off in my presentation, is that despite all the conventional observation that somehow things are at absolute standstill, there actually has been a lot of developments that's been happening on in cross-strait relations. There are subtle signals, signals that, you know, that still needs to be sort of modulated and figured out. And I think related to this observation is that nothing that I really said really represents any substantive new developments in what close observers in cross-strait relations have been monitoring for some time. But I think the pace and the sophistication of such activity is notable, right? I think while cross-strait relations right now are at a juncture, Taiwan itself is not really necessarily at a crossroad. And the reason why I say that is because the social political trends that sort of affected the 2016 elections appear to be still present. Mm-hmm. And it will continue to weigh on the political trajectory that's happening in Taiwan. And so so I think that's an important observation to in assessing what the implications are in terms of future cross-strait negotiations might be operating under. I think one of the sort of the policy implications that I hope could be derived from what I've been telling is that in light of the Thai administration's policy platforms and low-key approach, I believe also that the onus should be on Beijing to resume official communications with Taiwan. Also related to that is it would be analytically convenient to characterize the sort of the low approval ratings in size of low approval ratings to cross-strait relations, my personal assessment is that such assessments overlooks the critical domestic issues that have troubled her administration since the very beginning of her administration inauguration. And one of the things that it was quite interesting in terms of Professor Matsuda's comments and also Professor Chisako is the focus on Xi Jinping and in the way he approaches policymaking towards Taiwan. And if I may just add to perhaps the literature of sort of
what reflects Beijing's attitude is one interesting assessment that was made back in May of last year was sort of a psychoanalysis that was done by a Beijing a general who was retired, I think Wang Weixing. He wrote an editorial basically characterizing her as extreme and emotional because she's a single woman politician who was prone to a radical style because she lacked the burden of love, family, and children. So I think that that is the type of attitude that pervades, the type of assessment that, I mean, I'm saying this is more anecdotal, right, than a broad conclusion of what they've, but the attitude, but I think it reflects a type of attitude towards telling one that that affects how their policy mindset towards working with Tsai. I have more to add, but you know, I'll keep it at that.
Well, one should note that they took that sort of media report down very quickly.
Okay, good.
So let's open it up. We have about an hour, not an hour, half an hour. When I call on you, please wait for the mic. Identify to whom your question is posed, and please keep your question short. So I saw Nadia Tsao in the back.
Thank you, Richard, and thank you for the panel. I think one thing Professor Matsuda mentioned is the inconsistency of a Chinese response to Tsai Ing-wen's policy or, you know, the appointment that the people he nominated to represent her. But the panel, I wonder, other panelists, could you comment, you know, how do you see this inconsistent? There any signal from that? And a few things doesn't seem to relate it, but I think actually do. One thing is the inconsistency. The other is the change of a personnel in the, you know, the people who are handling Taiwan affairs in China. With the people have more knowledge of international community or relations. And also, you know, I think in general, the atmosphere, maybe you already seen that, the criticism from Zhang Zhijun and the response from Taiwan, it seems like, you know, the relationship between Taiwan and China's people who are working on the Taiwan issue pretty sour at this moment. So why do you think this is happening? Thank you.
She's asking other comments.
I would say one thing about Mr. Yang Mingjie. At first, this seems like an implausible choice, but it's my understanding that Mr. Yang, in addition to his other substantive expertise, is also an expert on crisis management. And so this may suggest that there's a desire to have somebody with those skills in place if a crisis occurs. I'm not saying that they're believing that a crisis will occur. But that that they want to be ready. As for the sour mood, there may be something of an echo chamber on the PRC side, that there's a kind of groupthink that nothing good can come from Tsai Ing-wen, and we need to look for a time when the Kuomintang comes back to power. I don't know. It's just a suggestion. I wanted to ask Matsuda-san another question. You're teaching in Taiwan right now, and we have this interesting phenomenon going on in Taiwan society now of essentially delegitimizing Chiang Kai-shek and his role in Chinese history and Taiwan's history. And I wonder if you have any observations about that and the implications of it for cross-strait relations.
Well, because I was not that healthy, so I didn't go out so frequently, so I don't know much about that. But I think that, on Chiang Kai-shek's issue, the Taiwan's society is quite divided. Mm-hmm. But the Chiang Kai-shek supporters are a shrinking market, basically. So I think that basically this is going to be a long-term trend. Mm-hmm. This is going to be a long-term trend. And in comparison with the Chen Shui-bian administration, I think that still Taiwan administration is doing a relatively softer measures, taking relatively softer measures. So the impact on the cross-rate relation is not that strong. You know, if China wants to smash Taiwan, China can pick up any reasons. But if it doesn't want to smash Taiwan, try to make something positive, it can simply ignore it.
Okay. Yes, right here. Wait for the mic.
I have a question both for Professor Matsuda and Dr. Bush. And Matsuda-san, your analysis listed five possible outcomes for the cross-strait relationship, including the win-lose scenario in which Taiwan accepts China's demand for unification. I guess you did not explicitly mention the possibility of a more forceful route for China to achieve that possibility, either through military intervention or through economic warfare. I would appreciate your elaboration, whether you see that forced intervention on Taiwan as a plausible scenario in the foreseeable future, or what you see reasons that China might hesitate to take that route. And the question for Dr. Bush is, from the American perspective, if such a forced intervention happens, do you foresee likely that the United States will stand by Taiwan and try to maintain its survival? Thank you.
Okay. There are so many slides in my presentation, and in the very first slide, I put the two words, aggregate power and issue-specific power. And yes, the power balance between the mainland China and Taiwan are, very much tilting toward the mainland China. But mainland China would not use force, so quickly. And as for mainland China, economic interactions are very important for the sake of its own development. So it's not that easy or good for China to use force or economic sanction that quickly. So although China has a very strong aggregate power, but in terms of the cross-strait relations, in issue-specific, field, China cannot use that. Cannot use that nuclear weapon or aircraft carrier. That just showing and keep pressuring, but actually use of force is quite a different matter. If you want to end the rise of China, you use the force. But it's the most ridiculous way. I don't foresee that.
Thanks for your question. When I was a diplomat, I had a self-imposed rule to never answer hypothetical questions because you always get in trouble. And your question is the hardest hypothetical question. First of all, let me say that I agree with Professor Matsuda that Beijing has a lot of reasons not to use force against Taiwan. First of all, it can believe, and I hope it believes, that someday the Kuomintang will come back to power and things will get better again. So why use military means to achieve your political objectives if you think you can achieve them through political means? and you minimize the risk of U.S. Response. The basic answer to your question is that what the United States does will depend very much on the circumstances and how it sees its role in Asia and the degree to which it believes, among other things, that what it does concerning the defense of Taiwan will affect its credibility throughout Asia and around the world. I think that would weigh very heavily on American decision makers. Another question?
May I
please.
Regarding the economic sanctions, China has sent messages and using or mobilizing Taiwanese medias, some medias, that the tourism is going to maybe zero or something. But what happened last year was only 16.1 reduction. And tourism toward Taiwan as a whole boomed and hit the record high last year. So I think that what we are witnessing is a kind of propaganda, rather than a reality. So we have to take a look at what's happening very carefully.
If I could follow up my own answer. The most likely case in which Beijing would use force if there were a decision on Taiwan to move to de jure independence. But I don't think there's going to be that decision. Taiwan people are too smart for that. And public opinion wouldn't support it. Furthermore, we need to step back again and ask, why is Beijing not achieving its political objective of unification? I think the main reason is that the formula that it has offered to Taiwan, and it first did it 35 years ago, isn't acceptable to but a small minority on the island. Perhaps if it changed the offer, it might get a better response.
Richard, if I may just follow up on that and return to Nadia's question about the observation about inconsistency. And following on what you just said there is that I would sort of take a different characterization observation is that, in fact, the PRC has been fairly consistent in terms of its policy towards Taiwan. And as Richard mentioned there, it's based on its one country, two system formula for unification. And its approach to Taiwan, however, in terms of applying pressure or less pressure or more pressure, is in the approach in terms of how it sees it can affect public opinion in Taiwan to manipulate the results that it seeks, the political objectives that it seeks in the different administration that follows. So,
okay. Another question? We'll start with the person on this side, right there, and then we'll go to the person in the red tie.
Thank you to Brookings and the distinguished speakers for your words this morning. My name is Chris. I'm from Johns Hopkins Heights across the street. I was wondering if you could evaluate Xi Jinping and mainland China's policy of engaging with the grassroots, the students, the lower income families that they've noted is an area in Taiwan where the identity problem is particularly acute. Thanks.
I mean, I'll take the first approach of that, if you don't mind. But yes, I think After the Sunflower Movements in the spring of 2014, there was at that point a scheduled visit by Zhang Zijun, but was postponed and because of the protests that occurred, and there were I believe a reevaluation at that point to try to get in touch with the grassroots in Taiwan to get more acclimated with what the social forces that are at play affecting Taiwan's politics. Whether or not that has actually panned out and been how they've executed it, they've certainly paid more lip service to the need for more youth exchanges. This was highlighted most recently in the National People's Congress meetings, where I believe Yu Zhengsheng, who is the chairman of the CPPCC, to include also, I think, the deputy director of the Taiwan Affairs Leading Small Group, have repeatedly stated that one of the main thrust of, you know, sort of approach to Taiwan policy will be to try to encourage more youth exchanges. Again, that, you know, I think that it still remains to be seen exactly how that's going to pan out, and, you know, to realize the results from that.
I would only add that I'm not sure that these exchanges are the best way to deal with the PRC's youth problem in Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the problem is more profound than that.
Mm-hmm.
Beijing has the same problem concerning youth activists in Hong Kong as it does in Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it may have a similar problem within China one of these days. This is a global phenomenon, and I'm not sure any political leadership that's one or two generations older than these very innovative young people has a clue what to do about them. The gentleman on the other side there with the red tie or orange.
This is for all the panelists. How do you see budding friendship between Trump and Abe? How do you see that affecting cross-strait relations?
And you are?
I'm Tom Shattuck from the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia.
Thanks. You want to Trump and Abe?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, in my view, Abe might be able to help Trump to persuade that there is a value to pay more attention to Taiwan. I think sometimes it is too excessive, but Abe's government is pretty much occupied about this China threat concept. And in order to deter China, he's making a lot of active movements all around the world. And his picture, Taiwan certainly has a value. So from this perspective, I think he might be able to help Tsai Ing-wen to have a better international environment.
So could you talk a little bit more about the specific things that Prime Minister Abe has done or might do to deepen Japan's relations with Taiwan?
As I have mentioned in my presentation, he has changed the name of the representative, Japanese representative, to Taiwan. And I think there was some sort of negotiation between the Taiwanese side as well, because they're also changing it and explicitly going to mention that it is the organization that deals with Japan and Taiwan relations. Not like Taipei. So that's clearly one move, but probably the follow-up will be much better for Professor Matsuda.
Let me follow up. the biggest possible agenda was, free trade agreement between Japan and Taiwan. But the Japanese government set the prerequisite. That's the open up the market to Japanese food. And the domestic argument about Japanese food in Taiwan is, objectively speaking, fairly unscientific.
Uh-huh.
And millions of, tens of millions of people are eating foods in certain districts every day, including me, But in Taiwan, the discussion is very much extreme. And so that the FTA-related discussion is also stopped. I think that there could be some other approach, for example, and opening up the food, the market food is one thing, but the discussion over the FTA is, doing at the same time or something like that. But anyway, the Japanese government has to rethink its approach. Otherwise, I think that this is a kind of total dead end.
I think this issue is a useful reminder of Taiwan's active civil society.
Yes.
It's not just political parties that are actors, but you have independent groups, for example, on food safety, that can set the tone for both domestic politics and external policy.
Yeah, I have many Chinese friends, and I always say to them that you and us are all the victims of the some extreme movements in Taiwan. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's unnecessarily demonized the mainland China, and sometimes Japan. So,
Richard, if I may, I just want to add additional one data point to this discussion, and that is I think it's worth noting that the National Institute for Defense Studies, Japan's NIDS, had just recently released a China-Taiwan report and its annual defense report. And I think that that is a significant contribution in itself while not an indicator of Japanese government policy, but nevertheless, one that helps to inform policymakers to make better decisions. Certainly, we can pick at the contents of the report and its characterizations and its analysis. But I think in itself, the report represents, I think, not an insignificant contribution in the focus of Japan on China and Taiwan.
Thank you. Okay, the woman at the back, and then there may have been one over there.
Thank you, Jeanette Jiang, China Times Taiwan. I just want to follow, Richard, your mention about this. Maybe China need to change the offer because the unification obsolete. And Russell also mentioned that one country, two system, they actually not sell well in Taiwan. So my question is, what is the new formula would be, and how can two sides actually reach the formula?
This is another very hard question. It's not hypothetical, but it's hard. I think the underlying problem is the strong belief and widespread belief on Taiwan that Taiwan or the Republic of China is a sovereign entity, and that that has to be the starting point for any discussion of unification. So, if there is to be convergence in resolving the fundamental dispute, you need to find something that both allows a political union, but it acknowledges that the belief in Taiwan that it is a sovereign entity. And there are political forms that do that. Like confederations, those are very hard to construct, very hard to maintain, as our own country's history has demonstrated. Another sort of scenario is that people on Taiwan just give up this belief and claim that they are a sovereign entity. I also think that to get to this point requires a lot of discussion and among experts on both sides, and maybe these experts and their political leaders could come to a wholly new approach to this problem. I think that's more likely to happen in a situation where cross-strait relations are stable, mutually beneficial, and mutually non-threatening.
Richard, maybe if I could just add one point.
Sure.
To that. And I'd like to go back to the comments that the former ITS director, Zhou Zhihui, made in late November of last year, where he suggested that there could be a creative framework. I mean, that was the demonstration, or to the extent that he represented an official view, which he works for a government-funded think tank, research institution. So how authoritative he represents the policy of the PRC, it's hard to to really assess that. But that was a demonstration of some flexibility. But there has been that signal has basically, I haven't heard any kind of reinforcement of that signal since. And there's been a doubling down by the the senior policymakers on you know on the emphasis on the 1992 consensus and much more you know restrictive approaches to a cross-strait formula. I will also lastly just point out that you know there's been indication that the Thai administration is in the midst of planning a new framework or for a new policy cross-strait policy that will be announced later this year. So I think it's important to stay tuned to that too. So.
I would note, Russell, first of all, that this idea of different language mm-hmm. to accomplish the same thing is not new.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It goes back almost 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
Second, the requirement that this be a formula based on one China still exists. And I think the core connotation of one China would be at the heart of it, or would have to be at the heart of it, to be acceptable. Also, I think that one reason that there may not have been any follow-up was the fact that the Tsai-Trump phone call took place just a few days later, and that just changed the environment as far as Beijing was concerned. And you know, if they were hoping for the Tsai administration to pick up on it, maybe their hopes disappeared. Do you have a Joe Bosco, right on the center on the aisle.
Thank you. Joe Bosco, formerly with the Defense Department.
Can you move the mic a little bit closer?
Yes. Richard, you mentioned in response to the question as to how the U.S. might respond to a use of force by China against Taiwan, that it would depend on the circumstances, which, of course, is the classic definition of strategic ambiguity, which means that there are circumstances under which the United States would not defend Taiwan. You didn't indicate what those circumstances might be, but it's worth speculating further on that. But more importantly, I'd like you to comment on the reverse dynamic, that is, China's decision to use force will depend on how it assesses a U.S. response. Mm-hmm. Therefore, to the extent it believes the U.S. will respond, it is far less likely to use force, which, to my mind, puts in question the whole utility of the strategic ambiguity approach. I wonder if you would address that and also speculate on how the Trump administration's apparent willingness to upset the status quo or rethink fundamentals may cause a change in Taiwan, in China's approach to Taiwan?
All good questions, all hard to answer. Let me start and work back. Number one, it depends on which tendency in the Trump administration or the tendencies that I identified as my believing were at work in the Trump administration are at play. I mean, if there's more emphasis on sort of upgrading in various ways our relations with Taiwan, then that invites one PRC reaction. If, on the other hand, there is a serious intention to use Taiwan as a bargaining chip, which they say they're not going to do, then that leads to a different PRC judgment. On the PRC perception of what the U.S. would do in the event that it chose to mount an attack, strategic ambiguity can be judged in terms of things that we say. It can also be judged in things that we do. And the PRC, for its part, has to look at both. And then it has to act accordingly. I've always thought that the efforts that Beijing has undertaken at some great cost to create capabilities to counter intervention, what we call anti-access area denial, suggests that the assumption of Beijing's policy is that we will intervene. If they had any doubt then you know they wouldn't be spending that money on sort of everything involved. But so I think that you know so far they've assumed that we would intervene, that they can't run the risk that we wouldn't. I also think that the United States has and will work full-time through diplomacy to avoid the development of a situation where Beijing feels it has to use force. Now, what are the circumstances that might lead Beijing to use force where we wouldn't respond? You know, hard to say. I would say that an action on the part of Taiwan's leadership to say we are the Republic of Taiwan and we have nothing to do with China, that would probably invite a military response. Polling suggests that a lot of people on Taiwan understand that. And so I think that no Taiwan leadership would undertake that kind of action. But that's sort of hypothetically is what would create that situation. I would say that another thing that governs the PRC willingness to use force is its assessment of Taiwan's own capabilities and its ability to hold on until the United States could get into the fight if it chooses to do so. It's not an insubstantial factor. There was one other person. Okay, let's go to that gentleman, then we'll go back there.
My name is Takahiro Motegi. I'm a visiting fellow at CSS Japan Champ. My question goes to Dr. Bush. It's a quick question. How do you see the possibility that Donald Trump will try to implement armistice to Taiwan, for example, before the 90s Congress? Thank you very much.
I don't know. It's a good question, but I don't have enough information to give you an answer. So further back.
I think my name is Ken Scabbett, also the visiting fellow in GSS. So my question is go to Professor Matsuda. So I want to ask the same question. So in the case of the crisis between the close trade issue, how would Japanese government react it? This reaction should be the connection with the U.S. force or independent as a Japanese defense?
I haven't been asked that question for 8 years. So I have to remember the answer I made 8 years ago. But basically, under the current Japanese system, basically Japan would not defend other nations or, for example, in this case, Taiwan, based on the collective self-defense right directly. So the only possible way is to coordinate with military if U.S. military wants to deal with the Taiwan Strait crisis. And the approach is that Japan can assist U.S. military in the rear area and give a support. And in the past, that was excluding live ammunition and physical support. But now it also includes live ammunition and fuels and so on. And after 2 years ago, the new legislation passed. But Japan's approach is still strategic ambiguity. So it never says that, you know, Taiwan is included or excluded. So Japan's action will be decided by the characteristics of the situation. So Japan would never try to, you know, break the status quo. So that's Japan's, you know, basic.
Well, let's hope that these dark scenarios never happen.
So far, you know, China, when China is very confident, China would not use very extreme, you know, measures like use of force. When China feels challenged and feel, you know, vulnerable, and China may take a very extreme actions. And so far, I think that China is a little bit confident compared to the past. Time is standing by China. That's the Chinese you know, mindset now. So I don't foresee a serious situation would occur in a foreseeable future.
So thank you. We've run out of time. Thank you for attending and for your great questions. Thanks to all of the panelists for their contribution. So thank you again.